Steve Lochran from Hortonworks. He will talk about Hadoop, Hive, Spark, and object stores. Thank you.
Hello, I'm Steve Lochran. I'd like to introduce myself these days as I'm the person who wrote the middle of your stack traces. Okay, when you see a stack trace, mine's the bit in the middle. So if something says org Apache Hive, org Apache Spark, that's other people's problems. If it says com AWS, other people's code. When it says org Apache Hadoop, maybe mine. So I'm here to talk about how we're making those stack traces in the middle faster. We haven't had any demos yet today, have we? Have we seen any demos? No. All right. We'll start with a nice simple demo here. Somewhere at Amazon have a massive collection of satellite photographs where you can get where there's a little CSV file telling you what is actually there. They've got the photographs. And there's a cloud cover. Normally between 0 and 100 that actually goes negative. So it shows in the rig demo, I want a number between minus 10 and 100, and we'll do a select statement on it. Any volunteers for a number? Everyone's half asleep, aren't they? Come on, Alan, think of a number. Think of a percentage. Give me a percentage to show this is not 50%, there we go. 50%, all right, so I'm gonna do a select statement here. I'm actually using Spark data frame to actually query data against, I'm running that as a Scala test. We'll set it off running, okay? A little background demo. So this talk is about object stores, Spark, and Hive. Hands up, who's using Hive? Hands up, Spark. Hands up, something else. Hands up, who is working with Amazon S3 data? Right. Okay. Microsoft Azure, Google Cloud, anyone? Which one were you using at the back? Okay. It's completely unrelated. I thought it was answering a question. Okay. So, I'm talking about object store integration. As background, even though I'm talking about work I've done, a lot of the credit really goes to some of my colleagues. Rajesh Balamohan, who is not here, who is in Bangalore, who's doing all the performance work, telling us to what wasn't working, and Krishna Roth, who is in the Hadoop team, who is actually busy with me implementing the things that Rajesh told us to. We all work on different bits of Hadoop. Chris and I at the Hadoop code level. Rajesh works in Tez and Hive and really understands performance. Now, the work I'm talking about today is based on a nice, simple project. Make Apache Hadoop really at home in the cloud. You've always been able to run Hadoop in the cloud, but it's always had little issues. Best to date, there's Microsoft HD Insight, which is actually full Apache Hadoop, and Amazon EMR. Are the people running Hadoop in cloud using Amazon EMR? Anyone? Amazon EMR's Hadoop? Okay. Do you like it? What don't you like about it? Time to come up, yeah. That's just Hadoop is slow to start, I'm afraid. I'm not going to blame Amazon for that. But one of our goals, nice simple one, we want to be a better Hadoop in Amazon than Amazon's own. Nice little ambition there. What are you going to do with these things? Well, if you look at a classic Hadoop cluster, physical one, you have an object store worth petabytes. You just keep throwing all your data in. The compute's there, so now you can start analyzing it. Do anything, queries, whatever you want. In cloud deployments, to do it properly, your application has to change a bit. You really want to kind of keep your cost down. Your clusters may be of limited lifespan. They may change. They may expand and contract. So your data, your persistent data, does not live in a virtual Hadoop cluster. Your persistent data has to live in the storage infrastructure which your infrastructure provider offers you, which is generally the lowest cost form of the object stores. Here's an example use case then. We're doing some kind of ETL application. You've got data coming in from phones, web apps, whatever, being stored into the object store, like S3. You can then bring up every night a 1 to 2 hour long Hadoop cluster purely for the ETL operation. You get all that stuff in, you start analyzing it, you merge with some other external data sources, chuck it out again into a different format, and that's you finished. After that's done, you can tear down the cluster. You can have a temporary HDFS cluster, which is good because you really want some high-performance storage next to your compute nodes, but your data, your final data, lives back on the cloud store. Another classic use case. Good fun, this one, to play with if you haven't already. Notebooks. Here, the data, like data collected in the overnight batch job, is all stored in data sets online, along with third-party stuff. You're running a notebook remotely to query that. Apache Zeppelin is the official ASF-approved one, but there's Jupyter as well. And here, because this is kind of data scientists, people working interactively, again, you only bring these clusters up for the hours they're in the building, really. If they're not working, you don't want to waste money by having a cluster you don't need. So again, dynamic data, dynamic compute clusters, static data in your object stores. Now, really cutting edge is actually streaming applications. Here's an example of one on Microsoft Azure. We're running Spark there. We've replaced HDFS completely with Azure Storage. But we have things out there generating data, saving it into Azure Storage for polling in Spark, and other event streams coming into Spark too. There's some live processing going on there, which then sticks the output into HBase for actual reporting and things. This kind of stuff is actually more cutting edge, and I think we're still learning what works and what doesn't in this specific environment. Okay, so streaming applications running in cloud infrastructure is a fun one. Hands up who's working on that. Everyone's scared to own up to it. There we go. Anyway, so central to all this stuff is we're using Apache compute infrastructure, different algorithms, platforms, APIs, libraries, but we've actually offloaded the persistent storage to the cloud provider, who normally have some kind of cloud store. These are not file systems. File systems have a nice simple model, files and directories. We know about these because we have laptops and we have files and directories, and we have a lot of preconceptions in our head related to that, where you can have files that have data and directories that have other files, and you can't have data in a directory or files can't have children, things like that. So we've got years of experience and misunderstanding, all of which go completely away in an object store. But for things like HDFS, all our expectations are valid. Somewhere out there in your HDFS cluster, we store copies of your data. When you save a file to HDFS, we take three copies, we scatter it around. The name node stores all the metadata, the information about where the data for a file lives, but also things like its parent directories, what's adjacent to it. This lets me do things like list all the files in an object store in a fraction of a second. It means I can do something like a rename just by moving it in the name node as a transaction without going anywhere near the data. Keep your eye on rename, okay? Rename comes up a lot in this talk. In a contrast, an object store, we have taken away the metadata. There is no name node anymore. There is just stuff. Blobs, as they're usually known. So blob store is the shorthand term for an object store. In the absence of anything resembling a name node, something has to work out which service to go to query the data. And that's done purely on some hashing algorithm based on the name of the object you're looking for. Objects have names. They look like paths, but they are not directories anymore. I have an object called work pending part 0. I have another object here called work pending part 1. Those are just two completely separate objects that happen to have similar names at the beginning. Whatever's running in EC2 or Azure Cloud will take a string like that, apply some hashing code to it, and say, okay, work pending part 1 lives on these three servers, work pending part 0 lives on those three services. It's based on the file name alone. It's also based on a secret algorithm applied to this file name alone that nobody ever tells you. Now, one of the fun things because of this is we can't do renames because the location data lives in is determined by its file name. If I want to rename something in Object Store, I have to copy and delete it. And that's where kind of the classic metaphors, the assumptions that we have about a file system completely fall out the window. We aren't working with what we think we're working. We work with them with REST APIs. You effectively use the HTTP calls you put to put something up there. You can use HEAD to query its status and its length, if it's there or not. Use GET to actually read the data, and use DELETE to delete it. So it's nicely cross-platform, but it's also each of these are a new HTTP request, which makes them expensive. It can take longer than you think. We also, there's generally some kind of list command in there where you say, give me everything matching a prefix and delimiter. That's the list call. It can take time. But the nice thing is, it takes time, but it can do a recursive listing all the way down the directory tree, because it's just saying what matches this pattern. The object stars are also, sadly, eventually consistent. When you work with something like HDFS, you write a file and it is there for everybody to see. When you delete the file, it is not there immediately for everybody to see. When I update it, they get the new copy. That does not happen in Object Store. I can say, right, the file's there, I can do a head on it, I get that data, everything's all well. Someone else can come in and delete that object, and it goes away. But just because it's gone away on one machine doesn't necessarily mean it's gone away on all the rest yet. Behind the scenes, they have to propagate the information that that file is no longer there, what's called a tombstone, round to the other servers and slowly delete it. I can come in with another request asking for that data, and if the load balancer sends it off to a machine where it's not being deleted yet, I still get it. I could also get the old data if there's been an update, and if you do a listing, the list might say it's still there too. That is a major trouble spot with code, that things are still there after you change them. Okay? It tends to show up more in testing than anything else, but it's also a real problem if you're trying to use the object store as the intermediate store for operations. If it uses the final destination for your work, this isn't a problem. But if you're trying to say, hey, let's get rid of HDFS and use S3, this is what's going to kill you. So, we have file systems, we have object stores. They are different. However, we work with them, we pretend they're just the same. We pretend that's like that in our heads, but also we pretend like that. Come in the back there, you're late, sit down. Nick's my official heckle person in all the talks. We use URLs to talk to them. We don't, in the code, we just say, oh, it's just a file system. We just use different URL to refer to the data. We just use HDFS as the prefix for URL to talk to HDFS. But the other file systems there, S3, Azure, all the rest of it, just a different prefix. What happens is, when you try to open a file in Hadoop APIs with a specific path, something in the code says, okay, let's look up the implementation class for this particular file system URL, URI, schema, whatever, and it returns it. And then you talk to it direct, irrespective of what is behind the scenes. Now, there's a lot of different URLs down there, and this is, for a second. It's just a different URL to read. That Landsat one, it's an S3A prefix. That's all it is. In fact, if I go back to that demo, it'll have finished by now in 15 seconds. So there, when I was doing that query, I got a number. I was reading in a ORC copy of some Landsat photograph data. I just said S3A, that's the prefix, and then I say, where in the object store, which object store, as a development one of mine, and the path, and it's just the code here to work with it, to actually read the data, to do the select data. It doesn't care that it's in an object store. All it knows is it's like a file system, only slightly slower, generally. So in Spark, I say, go read this object here, Landsat PDS scene list. That's one of the Amazon public files. You can write to it pretty much the same thing, ignoring that eventual consistency problem. I've got the data I've just read in, and I can say, write it as a Parquet file, write it as an ORC file, and it will just happen. Same thing in Hive. You've got data stored on object store. You basically declare it as an external table. So here is what structure looks like, the file system of the object, of the table. And then I can do a select on it. And I get some numbers back. Here is all the entities where the cloud cover is less than zero. So, Spark, Hive, other applications, provided you've got the class path right, provided you've got the credentials right, an object store roughly works exactly the same as a file. Streaming, I'll skip that for now unless people want questions. Anyway, so it's there. We have lots of object support in Hadoop, which means you have lots and lots of different libraries, lots of different URLs. Nobody understands the difference between them or why. This diagram here actually provides the secret history of why we have different URLs. Back in 2006, the first connector to Amazon S3 was written by Tom White, called S3. It was a wonderfully ugly hack to talk to S3 at the time, where you were limited in how big the files could be. And he implemented what looked like a Linux inode-based file system on top of Amazon S3. So it worked. It wasn't compatible with anything else. So a couple of years later, him and somebody else wrote something called S3N, native S3. Most code that talks to files in S3, they use an S3N prefix because that's the main one in Apache land. Off to the corner, Amazon produced EMR, which has its own file system client. They use the prefix S3. It's Amazon's code. The ASF knows nothing about it and cannot handle any support calls related to it whatsoever. What we've done ourselves is, first, myself and a few other people, we wrote connection to OpenStack Swift. And we ignored object stores for a bit in general, except writing tests for other things. But gradually, in about 2013, 2014, people started kicking up work with object stores again. Someone from Common Crawl got fed up with the fact that S3N was showing its age, unreliable. Every time we updated the jar, we depended on the library jet set, something broke somewhere. We moved the bugs around, was essentially it. So we decided in about 2013, 2014, that we would stop all work on S3N, use a new library, use Amazon's own SDK library, and come up with a replacement called S3A. The two live side by side in the Apache Hadoop code base on the basis that we didn't want to break anything existing. So we said, S3M, leave that, leave it alone. You can use it if you want to, but we won't fix. We're going to make this new one called S3A, and eventually, when we're happy with it, you'll be able to use it. So we started doing that 2014. About 2015, actually said, you're ready to use. Meanwhile, Microsoft had been writing and contributing code back to talk to Azure. So first, the Azure storage WASB client in a Hadoop Azure jar. Then, more recently, something involving Azure Data Lake. Completely off in the corner at Google, who are doing their own thing for Google Cloud. They have their own library. That's nothing to do with Apache. I would really like it if they picked up and used the tests which we in the Hadoop team provide to say, does my file system work? I can tell from bug reports I get related to Hive that Google aren't running those tests, which is a shame. Anyway, so that's how we're going. Most recently, down there, I've been busy with my colleagues on S3A, speed and scale. Because a big problem in this work is that, turns out, S3 is slow. Or more specifically, S3 is surprisingly slow, even when I'm running code in the same cluster. On Amazon EC2 infrastructure, and S3 is a short network connection away, it's still too slow to work with. So, we're aware of that fact. The question is, how do we fix it? And the secret is to be methodical, effectively. You work out where it is slow. You try and have a good idea why it is slow, and then you see if you can actually speed it up at all. And if you can't speed it up, say, can we avoid the bottlenecks? Can we just avoid them altogether? So analyze the problems. Next step, the read path, the read problem. Most work running on Hadoop, Hive, Spark, and that is reading more often than it's writing. So any effort we put in there benefits first. Then fix the write for getting rid of delays, getting maximum use of your bandwidth. After that comes some second order problems of setting up the query, dealing with the output and stuff like that. So read, write, and then the layers on top. But the first step is working out why things are slow. And this is where my colleague Rajesh, he put all the effort in of running massive large-scale benchmarks. This is called a flame graph. Anyone ever heard of these? There's a good paper in the ACM about it, but effectively what he has done is he's been running benchmarks of a TCP DS query over 200 gigabyte data sets, with the profiler actually saying where things are taking time and duration in the call stack. So it's, okay, here are all the operations, the methods that took time, and here's up the stack. And we can say, this is long, but that's deep. And then we're trying to identify from there which are the bits which go against the object stores that are taking time. And in fact, we actually have this same interactive demo here. This is just an SVG file. It comes out of the profiling, but I can click on something and say, hey, this is quite slow. Click on it, and it goes, okay, we are reading stuff in from an object store, and we're doing some SHA stuff. So you can grab this. You can start identifying trouble spots, SSL. So SSL is kind of slow, I think, would be the summary there. And here's a little very deep bit up here. What's causing the stack here? I'm trying to click on something. A bit too small. And we're doing some memory allocation. So you can basically, oh, it's cryo. Nobody wants to go near cryo. So you can do that work. We can start identifying where the trouble spots are. And once you've got an idea of what's causing problems, then you can start dealing with them. But it's that the key point is work backwards from benchmark tests, bug reports, real information saying there's a problem, and use that to drive your thinking rather than just staring at the code thinking, where could we make this fast? And here are the big performance killers. Looking to see if an object is there. Get file status is the Hadoop call to say, tell me about a file, give me its length. If it's a directory, tell me how many children, tell me it's a directory. There's some wrapper codes to say it exists or whatever. But basically, that's doing three separate HTTP requests. Every time you look to see what file's there, you're doing three calls, which is kind of a lot. Equally bad are reading, where we want to say, I want to read from a position. They took a long, long time. So now we know the problems are, how on earth do we go around fixing them? The answer is, you take advantage of the fact that all the source code is there for you to download, and you take a look at it, and you stare at this code, and you think, what were they doing when they wrote it? Because the reason all these reads are taking so long is we're saying, I want to read this much data from a certain position in the file, is that on a file system, you basically say, okay, seek, put your little disk head here, read in 100K, seek somewhere else afterwards. In an object store, we're actually having to make new HTTP requests. So every time I want to read at a position, I basically close the old, I remember where the old position was, I close that HTTP stream, I reopen a new HTTP stream with the content length header saying, here's where I start. I read in my 16 bytes or whatever. Then I go back to where I was by closing the HTTP stream and reopening it. And that's kind of expensive because it can take hundreds of milliseconds to reopen HTTP connections. It's HTTPS negotiation, it's network, TCP setup, all that crap. Nice simple fix then, we don't seek. We just stop seeking. Instead we say, we will remember where you are. When you say seek, we go, oh, well, we'll say we've moved, we'll pretend we've moved, but we're not actually going to do anything with the HTTP connection until you read the next byte. You may do a seek, 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 and then a read, so we just ignore all the intermediate states. So we do that. We also added the ability, when you start doing the counting, you realize that actually you are better off reading sometimes through hundreds of kilobytes worth of data over the network connection than it is to actually stop and reopen a new network connection. So we added a read ahead range, said, yep, I'm going to read 256K ahead, rather than bothering with setting up new HTTP connections. And this was all really good. We were all really, really happy with it, except it didn't actually do as much as we hoped. It turned out to be all cryo still sucked. And why is that? Why? Wow, and before people say, oh, it's just awk, Parquet had exactly the same problem. Okay, it's to do with the binary files. And the reason for that is because the way these systems work is the columnar formats, we basically say, okay, here is a column, such as, you know, image IDs, cloud cover, whatever. We store that all in one column with some index data at the top. Then we have another column, then we have another column. And at the end, we normally have summary data about what's been saved, schemas, that kind of stuff. And actually, there's a lot of seeking both backwards as well as forwards. So you open a file, it goes to the end, it reads some schema stuff, then it goes to the beginning, then it looks at a bit of a one column, If you've got a query, the predicate goes, actually, I don't need any of these columns. I'm going to skip forward another 10 megabytes. So it's doing a lot of jumping around, a lot more than just say something simple like, I'm going to read through a CSV file. So what was the fix? Well, the problem actually comes down to this, is that when we read files, we say, read from the current position to the end of my object. If you're reading all the way through something, like a gzip file, like a CSV file, that's exactly what you want to do. But it means if we need to break that HTTP connection, if we're saying, no, we can't read all the way to this 4 gigabyte file, we just want to seek backwards a little bit instead, we have to abort the TCP connection, create a new one, wait time, wait so long you can actually start seeing the gap in log messages. And it's just too much. And especially because you have to bear in mind that the clients to all these object stores, they're using HTTP 1.1. They're recycling the connections. So you don't need to break the connection. You want to keep that connection up, wait for the finished HTTP operation to finish, such as by reading and discarding the data, and then you can reuse that connection. So we added a new mechanism. EffortVise, an optional feature to say, just like POSIX EffortVise, to say, I'm going to be doing random access here rather than sequential. And we modified the S3A client to say, OK, in this situation, instead of opening to the end of the file, all the way to your content length, we're going to come up with a number, a shorter number, to tell you to read. It works really well for Orc and Parquet. It absolutely dies for classic I.O. of a gzip file, a CSV file, anything like that, precisely because we're doing lots of little blocks rather than just one big read, so there's overhead there. So we have to make this an option, I'm afraid. I think it would be nice to make it clever, and we could work things out as you go along, or make it an official API where things like, in a file system API, where applications can say, like Orc code, Parquet would say, I want to be doing random access. As it is, we've added it as an option just for S3A. We're going to be retrofitting it to some of the other things as well. Anyway, it goes on. The key thing is, as far as your reading stuff goes, every single HTTP request is sacred. You just basically go through the log and you say, oh, it's just one HTTP request. It won't do any harm. But then once you're going through 200 gigabytes worth of data having operations applied to it, it adds up. It adds up. And actually, it adds up in bills as well. If you're working with S3 remotely, you can run up bills here too. So it's actually cost effective too. So lots and lots of work here. I won't go into details. You can go and look at Jira Hadoop 11694 for a summary. Does it all work? And the answer is, it works for our test data, but that may be utterly meaningless for your applications. Okay, I'm going to make that quite clear. And actually, it really depends not just on your test data and even on your test queries, but even actually how you lay out the data. Because listing directories is actually incredibly expensive. We've seen situations where people are having problems, and you go, you've just partitioned your data really, really aggressively badly for an object store. Someone was having things like you were storing data by year, by month, by day, by hour, and then it was only like one file per hour, but that was like so many levels of directory structure that it was taking forever to list. So it's very subtleties like that can really kill your performance. But with that caveat, we are saying the latest version of HTTP, that's here 2.4 plus enhancements, but HTTP 2.5, compared to the older version of HTTP 2.5, is on average about 2.5 times faster. Now, that's not just our S3A work. It includes lots of work by other people there, like Jesus and Alan and that. But if you look here, here are various random queries in the TCPDS thing. Blue on the left is old. Red on the right is new. And generally, apart from some, which make show no change whatsoever, things have tended to get faster. Apart from one that actually got slower. We don't know why that was, but it was a transient in a particular test run. Actually, we do know why that is because when you're playing with VMs, you ask for a set of VMs a week after the previous set, you get different VMs back with different network situations back. So it's quite hard benchmarking this stuff. So we are faster than we were before. That's good. Are we better than Amazon? Again, in our limited benchmarks, we are seeing ourselves a lot faster on queries. So we are very happy. It says 2.8x there. When we do some experiments, I'd say that's probably quite good. We do actually talk to Amazon, and I suspect what they'll be doing is taking some of the code we've done and putting it back into theirs. Even if they don't publish their libraries, they are free to take all our code. So you're excited now. You're thinking, that's really good for Hive. What about Spark? The answer is, everything we've done right at the bottom applies. All the speed ups that I've written, the bits where you've optimized all the low-level stuff, that applies just as much to Spark as it does to Hive. We need to do a lot more work internally as part of the project on benchmarking that and dealing with some of the high-level aspects of Spark. A big problem Spark has, it does not have the right jars in place. There is a patch for that, Spark 7481. You can use that yourself to build, apply that patch, and you can build Spark with all the jars on. That's what we use to build. That's exactly the very same patch and basic integration tests that we use. I'm having a bit of an argument with the Spark team right now about whether it should go in or not. I don't think some people respect the value of packaging enough. Anyway, it's there. You need to get the right jars in your class path. Hadoop AWS, Hadoop Azure, and SWKs for Amazon and Azure. There was a really fun little bug with the AWS SDK that's actually will only be relevant if you're fielding support calls about unable to connect. But sometimes when you're trying to talk to Amazon using the S3A client and you get connection refused or credential failures, hypothesis one is, yes, my credentials are wrong. But there's another hypothesis, which is you're using Java 8 U60 JVM and there is a JODA time less than or equal to 2.8.0 on the class path. And at that point, for some reason, we can't set up a time value for Amazon to authenticate. So sometimes we get support calls related to things not authenticating, and actually it turns out to be class path problems instead. Class paths are always your enemy. There are various tuning options to deal with this stuff. If you really are using, I'll stick these slides up later, if you're playing with Spark, corner me them. But basically, for both Orc and Parquet, you just want to minimize the amount of I.O. you're doing. You tell them to the file formats themselves, do their own predicate pushdown to cache their answers. And F-advise random, random I.O., and a big read ahead. Those are the other two options you want. Spark also shows up a big problem we have writing to object stores. When you try and write to object stores, you do all your compute, and then it goes writing, and then there is a pause where if you're actually staring at it on the screen, you can just watch, and you can sit there, and there's a visible delay between the log info statements. And the reason for that is all the code in Hadoop, in Hive, in Spark, that writes data to an object store, to a file system, assumes that you can write all your data into a subdirectory of its final destination directory, and then, once the executor has finished, once it's happy with all its work, it can do a rename to the top-level directory, and everything is instantaneously there. The reason applications do that, they write into subdirectory, is it lets us get away with two things. It lets us handle failure so that if a job halfway through writing data suddenly failed, that incomplete data wouldn't be visible to anyone else. And it also lets us do speculative work where you can have more than one executor doing the same query, the same bit of work, generating what would roughly be the same output, and whoever completes first wins. They complete their data, they do the rename, and it goes into place. The second executor, when it reaches the end of its work, it does the rename, and now it fails because the destination is there. So we get away with the, we rely on the fact that rename is instantaneous and atomic to support failure modes and concurrent execution of queries. The bad news is, as I was hinting to earlier, rename is neither atomic nor fast in an object store. It is both non-atomic and very much not fast. In fact, you have to do a copy and delete on Amazon S3. It takes about 6 to 8 megabytes a second is the time it takes to copy data. That's within S3. Azure, it seems a lot faster. In fact, when you do a copy there, it seems so fast that it's not actually doing the work, which worries me a bit, but it seems to be consistent. There's not much you can do to fix it. My recommendation is turn off speculative execution. It's dangerous. Use algorithm 2 for your commitment, which says do the least amount of renames you can get away with, and turn off cleanups. All right, that's all you can do right now. That said, there is something that lives in the Spark code base called the direct output committer. This was originally written by Databricks, and it was in the Databricks libraries, and then it actually got pulled into Spark and Spark 1.6, one that will actually write straight to S3 without doing renames, right into its destination. That came into Spark in Spark 1.6. It got removed from Spark 2.0 because people, once you start using it, you start discovering quite how badly it can go wrong. So it's been deleted there because it was leading to corruption of data and you wouldn't realize it if you had a race condition. So Spark 2 has pulled it, and if you try and use anything to commit your data with the word direct in it and speculation enabled, you'll actually get told off by Spark and then it'll ignore you. They say, you didn't want to do that, and I'll pretend you didn't ask. So people ask for this. They say, where is the direct committer? And we say, we took it away because it was dangerous. However, people do want that fast output, which is why myself, some colleagues, and some of our arch rivals at Cloudera are collaborating on something called C Guard, to provide a fast, consistent metadata store for S3. That will give us significant speed-ups on the reads, significant speed-ups on the lists, and, as is my homework if I can get my maths together, a consistent commit operation without doing renames. How are we going to do this? We're going to use Amazon DynamoDB as a substitute for a directory server. Once you've got that, for people who don't know what Amazon DynamoDB is, it's Amazon's NoSQL database as a service running in Amazon AWS. It's fast, it is consistent. You have to pre-allocate how much kind of IO ops you're going to need, and you will pay for it. So it's not free. But you are getting a speed up in exchange for that. So the point we're trying to make here is, if you want either consistent operations or read performance, you can pay for a premium. Otherwise, we'll have things work at their current level without the extra money. But once it's there, then all those queries that will go to the object store will go straight to DynamoDB instead. I can do a head, I can do a list, all that kind of stuff happens there. Updates, such as deleting an object, I have to go to both places. If I'm deleting an object, I have to say, it's been deleted, then I have to delete the object. Whereas before, when I was showing, okay, we have a consistency where a delete may not be visible to the callers, even though it's happened, here, because everything is going to DynamoDB, they're going to get a consistent view of the world. And again, I do a put, update in both places. Now, it may end up that actually, there's a slightly different view of the world in here than there is in there. If things happen behind the scenes there that this thing doesn't get told about, it's going to get confused. Our stance there is going to be, do not do that. I think you're going to have to make a choice as to whether you want a consistent model. I know, Alan's frowning there. Is you either go through DynamoDB and have something fast and consistent, or you go as you would normally, and you can go inconsistent, and we're thinking about an option of saying just using this as a cache, where if it doesn't know the answer there, it will delegate. So we'll try and stay in sync, but the system of record is actually the object store rather than DynamoDB. Anyway, this is something we're working on. As is usual in ASF projects, I would encourage anybody who's interested in this to come and help. Coding, reviewing, and testing. Testing is really important in this space too. So, Fenn's excited about all this exciting work to make things like Spark and Hive faster. You can get hold of this stuff. Hands up who wants to get hold of this exciting new stuff. One person. Okay, come and talk to me afterwards. Never mind. Anyway. HTTP 2.5, later version of our product. All the read pipeline stuff that I was talking about earlier is already in there and shipping. The read pipeline and some scalability and performance work we've done on the right, that's coming in our still technical preview of HDP as a service on EC2. When we in the Hadoop team get organized enough to do another release of Hadoop 2.8, the long-promised Hadoop 2.8, all this stuff will be in there as well. And as for the S3 guard work, I have no timetable of when that stuff's going to be done. Okay, we're going to put that off until we've got it right. But don't worry, you don't have to wait for my code because your code has problems too. All of you. Your code doesn't really work properly in this environment. But that's okay because my code doesn't work properly either. I'll point out here, you can use bullet points, emojis as bullet points in PowerPoint, but actually there's a bug that you can't use all emojis, okay? So it's strange but true. Minimize all your queries to the file system. Listing, get file status, all that kind of stuff. Just try and do it as little as possible. It may be inexpensive in a real file system, but an object store, it's very expensive. So cache the answers, minimize the queries you make, and if you're doing something like a recursive directory walk, use the API calls, the Hadoop file system API calls, to do the recursive listing for you, rather than you try and implement it in your own code. Instead, what you should be doing is seeking forward in your code, trying not to rename things, but if you must rename, do it in a separate thread, and most importantly of all, test against object stores. There is no substitute in this world for testing against real object stores. If you want to say my code really works against Amazon S3, against Azure, against OpenStack, get an account there and test it. It doesn't cost that much money, provided you delete all the data afterwards, and Amazon provide lots of free data for the read pipeline as well. But just test it, make sure your code works. You will find surprises, I think. You know, where the bottlenecks are moves around in this world. So that is pretty much my overview of what I've been up to recently with my colleagues, and we hope to have this stuff in your hands as soon as we can. I look forward to all those stack traces in the bug reports related to my new code. Now, are there any questions? Yes, what is it, you in the back?
So I think that we've seen about 3 years ago, we've started having similar kinds of weird behavior where someone would switch out a file system implementation and rather than getting a little bit slower, it would get pathological. And they set up a rather terrifying randomization of their tests that would pick the worst cases it could, run it through and tell you how much worse it got. I think it's worth doing something similar so that developers
okay, the question there, didn't grab it, was Nick was saying Lucene did some stuff where they set out to somehow pathologically choose the worst pipeline ever. Was this actually just picking different file systems or actually mocking in delays?
They randomly pick all the different possible options.
Of object stores?
Okay.
I know they did. Lucene does some really fantastic stuff where it picks random locales and things like that, which it creates a more complicated test matrix. When it's a failure, you can say, hey, this test didn't work when I set the locale to be Turkey, okay, which is always the one. Object stores are weird, is the test runs vary from day to day. I was doing this little demo I gave at the beginning that took 15 seconds, I think it did. That took 15 seconds. I could run it again, and it was taking something like 1 minute 20 in the previous talk, and it's just because network connect traffic in the individual rooms. And so just generally rerunning tests and trying different scale parameters is actually quite a good way of stress testing tests, best of all. So I can create enough complexity and pain just by running the tests as it is right now. A good one was when I was doing the write pipeline, I was starting to upload 4, 5, 6 gigabyte files. And just over that long, that's basically long haul from where I work at home. And every so often, there'd be enough transient failures that we'd get to see a new stack trace and go, hang on, this bit isn't retrying properly. And we just hadn't noticed because you don't normally try and do a single put to Amazon S3 that takes over an hour. And you know, statistics have ended up catching you. So I think the real best way to find out to do the testing is actually wait for people out there in the world to run this code and then find out what's slow. I wouldn't have thought of having this pathologically suboptimal directory layout. Now we know somebody has and we told them to stop it. But it's not predictable. And it's those kind of surprises that are kind of the problem. It's not just configuration. It's just decisions people have made in their own application and the data structures that are going to cause problems. Any other questions? Oh, well, there we go then. I will thank you all for your attendance. You can always come and corner me about these questions. And I'm actually talking in Wednesday about performance in Hadoop clusters. Why is my Hadoop cluster slow? Which is utterly unrelated to this.
question about something totally different from the old stack. Do you see any change coming in that respect? I would say lead, like an egg, and new kind of connector, say, we made it way faster, but we don't have to relay.
They will have more problems.
In the other room, the wall is a new button, right? So beware. Oh, yeah. So if it's just beware, if it's colorful, that's the reason I came up to him, right?